Chapter 46. The sun blazed down on the asphalt outside the private aircraft terminal of the Managua International Airport as Pitt and Giordino stood under a covered patio and watched the Numa Citation jet land. The pilot took it down to the last turnout and taxied back to the terminal. As soon as the plane came to a halt, the door was opened from the inside and Rudy Gunn stepped to the ground. "Oh, no," Giordino groaned. "I can smell it in the air. We're not going home." Gunn did not walk towards them, but motioned for them to approach the plane. As they neared, he said, "Climb aboard. We haven't time to spare." Without comment, Pitt and Giordino threw their bags into the cargo compartment. They had no sooner sat down and snapped their seatbelt buckles than the turbines roared and the plane was speeding down the runway and rising into the air. "Don't tell me," said Giordino dryly. "We're going to spend eternity in Nicaragua." "Why the rush?" Pitt asked Gunn. "Dark and summer have disappeared," Gunn said, without prelude. "Disappeared," said Pitt, with a sudden flash of apprehension in his eyes. "Where?" "Guadalupe. The Admiral sent them to an offshore island to search for the remains of Odysseus's fleet of ships, thought to be destroyed there during his voyage from Troy." "Go on." "Mr. Charles Moreau, who is our representative for that part of the Caribbean, called last night and said that all communication with your son and daughter had ceased. Repeated attempts to contact them proved fruitless." "Was there a storm?" Gunn shook his head. "The weather was ideal. Moreau rented a plane and flew over Branwen Island, where Dirk and Summer were headed. Their boat had vanished, and there was no sign of them on or around the island." Pitt felt as if a great weight was pressing against his chest. The appalling possibility that his children might be injured or dead was barred from his mind. For a moment, he was incapable of believing harm had come to them. But then he looked into the face of the usually taciturn Giordino and saw a look of deep concern. "We're headed there now," Pitt said, as if it was a point of fact. Gunn nodded. "We'll land at the airport in Guadalupe. Moreau has arranged for a helicopter to take us directly to Branwen." "Any speculation as to what might have happened to them?" asked Giordino. "All we know is what Moreau has told us." "What of this island? Are there inhabitants? A fishing village?" A grave expression spread across Gunn's face. "The island is privately owned."
"By whom?"
"A woman by the name of Ipona Eliad." Surprise showed in Pitt's opaline green eyes. "Ipona? Yes, of course, it would be her. Hiram Yeager ran an extensive check on her. She's at the top level of Odyssey and is reported to be Spectre's right hand." He stopped and gazed at Pitt. "You know her?"
"We met briefly when Al and I rescued the Lowenhearts and snatched Flidaeus. It looked as though she was high in the Odyssey hierarchy. I understand she wasn't killed during the fighting at Odyssey's research center. Apparently, she slipped through the net before the center was destroyed. Admiral Sandecker asked the CIA to trace her. One of their agents reported that her private jet was detected by satellite on a landing approach to the airfield on Branwen Island." Pitt was holding in his fear with difficulty. Then he said in quiet certainty, with unshakable conviction in his voice, "If Ipona is responsible for any harm that might come to Dirk or Summer, she'll never live to collect her retirement pay."
Dusk had turned to dark when the Numa jet landed in Guadalupe and taxied to a private hangar. Moreau was standing beside the ground crew as Pitt, Giordino, and Gunn exited the plane. He introduced himself and quickly escorted them less than 100 feet to a waiting helicopter. "An old Bell jet ranger," said Giordino, admiring the beautifully restored old helicopter. "I haven't seen one of those in a while."
"It's used for tourist sightseeing," explained Moreau. "It was all I could arrange on short notice."
"She'll do just fine," said Pitt.
He threw his duffel bag inside and entered the craft, moving to the cockpit, where he conversed briefly with the pilot, a man in his early 60s with many thousands of hours in the air in 24 different types of aircraft. After he lost his wife to cancer and retired as chief pilot on a major airline, Gordy Shepherd had come to Guadalupe and took a part-time job flying tourists around the islands. His hair was a neatly brushed bush of gray that complemented his black eyes.
"That's a maneuver I haven't attempted in a long time," said Shepherd after hearing Pitt's instructions.
But I think I can handle it for you.
If not, Pitt said with a taut grin, my friend and I will hit the water with a force of cannonballs.
Outside, Gunn thanked Moreau and closed the door as the rotor blades began to slowly revolve, increasing their beat until the pilot lifted the craft off the ground. It took less than 15 minutes to cover the 27 miles from the airport to the island. At Pitt's request, once they were over water, the pilot flew without lights. Flying above the sea at night was like sitting blindfolded in a closet sealed with duct tape. Using the light beacon on the island as a guide, Shepard flew an unerring straight line for the south shore. Back in the passenger compartment, Pitt and Giordino opened the duffel bag and put on wetsuits and nothing else except hard rubber boots. They carried no scuba gear, fins, or masks, only weight belts to compensate for the buoyancy of the neoprene wetsuits. The only equipment Pitt took was his satellite phone inside a small waterproof bag tightly belted to his stomach. Then they moved to the rear of the compartment and opened the cargo hatch. Pitt nodded at Gunn. Okay, Rudy. I'll call in case we need a quick getaway. Gunn held up his phone and grinned. It shall remain glued to my hand until you tell me to evacuate you, Al, and the kids off the island. Though he didn't fully share Gunn's optimism, he was grateful for the show of confidence. He lifted a phone from a vertical base on the bulkhead and called the pilot. All set back here. Stand ready, instructed Shepard. We'll be coming up over the harbor in 3 minutes. You sure you've got enough water depth for your dive? Jump, Pitt corrected him. If you programmed the correct GPS coordinates and stop on them, we should have enough water to cushion us from striking the bottom. I'll do my best, acknowledged Shepard. Then your friend, Mr. Gunn, and I will make it look like we're flying on toward another nearby island before circling back and waiting for your call to come and get you. You know the drill. I wish you boys luck, Shepard said over the phone as he closed communications to the passenger compartment. Then he straightened in his seat with both hands and feet on the controls and focused his mind on the maneuver coming up. The island looked dark, as if it was deserted. The only light was the beacon above its metal frame. Pitt could just vaguely distinguish the faint outline of the buildings and the Stonehenge replica in the middle of the island on a slight rise. It would be a tricky approach, but Shepard seemed as calm as a mobster in a box seat at the Kentucky Derby, knowing the fastest horse was about to throw the race because he paid off the jockey. Shepard brought the old Bell Jet Ranger in from the sea right up the center of the channel into the harbor. In the rear, Pitt and Giordino stood poised in the cargo door. The airspeed was nearly 120 miles an hour when Shepard's hands and feet danced over the controls and the helicopter stood on its tail and came to an abrupt stop, twisting to starboard and allowing Pitt and Giordino to jump unobstructed through the door into the darkness. Then Shepard pushed the helicopter forward and picked up speed again, banking around the island and heading out to sea. The entire maneuver went off flawlessly. To anyone observing on the island, it hardly looked like the helicopter came to a stop. Holding their breath, Pitt and Giordino dropped 30 feet before striking the water. Despite their attempts to fall cleanly feet first, the sudden tilt of the helicopter prevented a smooth jump. They found themselves tumbling through the air and doubled up with arms clasped around their knees to prevent smashing into the solid wall of liquid in a flat position that could have badly injured them, or at least knocked the wind out of their lungs and rendered them unconscious. The neoprene wetsuits absorbed most of the harsh impact as they struck the surface and plunged nearly 10 feet into the deep before losing all momentum. Feeling like they'd run a gauntlet through sadists beating on them with flat boards, they stroked to the surface just in time to see a pair of searchlights flash on and sweep the water until they found their target and lit up the helicopter like a Christmas tree ornament. Shepard was an old pro who had flown in Vietnam. He anticipated what would happen next. He suddenly dipped the helicopter toward the sea in a steep dive just as a hail of automatic rifle fire split the night and sprayed the area a good 100 feet behind the tail rotor. Then he spun the aircraft wildly and clawed for altitude. Again, the gunfire went wide. Shepard knew his antics wouldn't keep the wolves from his door much longer, not with the searchlights clinging to him like leeches. Second-guessing the gunman on the island, he brought the Bell to a quick stop and hovered for a split second. The gunmen, having learned their lesson, led the helicopter and fired at its intended path, but Shepard had conned them again. The trajectory of their fire tore through the air 50 feet in front of the cockpit.
Incredibly, Shepard had gained over half a mile on the gunners and swooped away as the parting shots stitched the fuselage, worked their way toward the cockpit, and shattered the windshield. A bullet struck Shepard's arm and passed through his biceps without hitting bone. Gunn had flung himself down and forward and took a small crease on the top of his head that would have removed half his skull if he hadn't ducked. In the water, Pitt watched with growing relief as the helicopter flew beyond the range of the island's gunners and vanished into the darkness. Not knowing if Gunn or Shepard had been injured, he knew that they could not return as long as concentrated fire swept the skies above the island. "They can't return until we take out the searchlights," said Giordino, floating on his back as leisurely as if he was in the pool at his condo. "We'll worry about that little problem after we find out what happened to Dirk and Summer." Pitt stared at the island, his voice firm with the confidence of a man who was gazing at something unseen by others. Then he saw the searchlights lower their beams and began sweeping over the waters of the harbor. They dove under, not wasting a breath on warning the other, knowing their instincts were tightly bonded over the years. Pitt rolled over on his back at 10 feet and stared up at the surface, seeing the glow of the brilliant light flash over the surface with the brightness of the sun. Only when the lights moved off did they surface and catch a breath. They had been down over a minute, but neither gasped for air, having practiced the art of holding their breath for deep dives without breathing equipment. When the light beams above danced away, they surfaced, took a breath, and dove again. Warily watching the movements of the searchlight and timing its sweep to gain air, they began stroking toward shore that was little more than 100 yards away. At last, the lights blinked out and they could resume swimming on the surface. 10 minutes later, their feet touched sand. They rose to their feet, dropped their weight belts, and crept into the shadows beneath a bank of rocks, resting for a few moments while appraising the situation. "Where to?" asked Giordino in a whisper. "We've landed south of the house and about 200 yards east of the Stonehenge replica," Pitt replied quietly. "A folly," said Giordino. "What?" "Fake castles and facsimile ancient structures are called follies, remember?" "It's burned in my brain," Pitt muttered. "Come on, let's scout around, find and sabotage the searchlights. It won't do to have them expose us like a pair of rabbits." It took them another 8 minutes to locate the twin searchlights. They almost stumbled on them in the dark. The only thing that saved them from being discovered by the guards manning the lights was their black wetsuits, which made them almost invisible in the night. They discerned the outlines of one man lounging on his back in the sand while another peered out to sea with night glasses. Not expecting intruders from their rear creeping onto the raised stand mounting the lights from behind, they were not alert. Giordino came out of the darkness silently, but the squeak of his rubber-soled boots gave him away, and the man with the night glasses spun around and in time to see a shadow coming at him out of the night. He grabbed an automatic rifle propped on its butt against the light mount and swung the muzzle toward Giordino. He never pulled the trigger. Pitt had come up from the opposite side, 5 steps ahead of his friend. He snatched the rifle out of the guard's hands and clubbed him over the head with the stock. Then Giordino was on the guard relaxing on the ground, knocking him unconscious with a well-delivered fist to the side of the jaw. "Doesn't it give you a comfortable feeling to know we're armed?" said Giordino buoyantly, as he disarmed the guards and handed Pitt one of the rifles. Pitt didn't bother to reply as he unlatched the lenses of the searchlights, swung them open, and lightly, with the slightest of sound, smashed the filaments. "Let's check the house next. Then your folly." There was no moon, but they took no chances and moved slowly, cautiously, barely seeing the ground beneath their feet. The hard rubber boots protected their feet from the sharp coral that lay between patches of smooth sand. They found a frond under a palm tree and dragged it behind to obscure their footprints. If they couldn't get off the island before daylight, they would have to find a place to hide out until Moreau and Gunn could arrange a rescue. The house was a large colonial structure with a wide veranda running around the entire building. They crept onto the veranda, moving silently in their rubber-soled boots. A single light could be seen through a crack in the boards over the windows, put there to protect them from the ravages of a hurricane-inspired gale. Pitt moved on his hands and knees to the window and peered through the crack. The room on the other side was bare of furniture. The interior had the look of a house that hadn't been lived in for years. Unable to see a need for further stealth, Pitt stood and said to Giordino in a normal tone, "This place is abandoned and has been for a long time." The expression of puzzlement on Giordino's face was not visible in the darkness.
That doesn't make sense. The owner of an exotic island in the West Indies who never stays in the only house. What is the purpose of owning such a spot?
Moreau said aircraft and people came in and out during certain times of the year. They must have some other place for guests to stay.
It would have to be underground, said Giordino. The only surface structures are the house, the folly, and a small aircraft maintenance hangar.
Then why the armed reception committee, mused Pitt. What is Epona trying to hide?
He was answered by the abrupt sound of strange music, followed by an array of colored lights that flashed on and around the Stonehenge folly.
The door to Dirk's cell clanged as it was thrown open against its stop. The afternoon heat lingered and the small airspace was still sweltering hot. The female guard motioned him out into the hallway with the muzzle of her rifle. Dirk felt a sudden cold, as if he had stepped into a refrigerator. Goosebumps ran down his arms and across his back. He knew it was useless to question the guard. She would tell him nothing of interest. They did not enter the exotically decorated room, but passed through a door and stepped into a long concrete corridor that appeared to stretch into infinity. They walked for what seemed almost an entire mile before coming to a circular staircase that wound upward for what Dirk estimated as 4 stories. At the top, a landing led through a stone arch to a large throne-like chair that sat dimly illuminated by a golden light. 2 women in blue gowns stepped out of the darkness and chained him to rings clamped into the chair. One of them tied a black silk gag over his mouth. Then all 3 women faded back into the darkness. Suddenly, an array of lavender-colored lights flashed on and swirled around the interior of a concave stone amphitheater bowl built without seats for an audience. Next, a set of laser beams lit the black sky, illuminating a series of columns spaced around the bowl and a larger outer ring of black lava columns. Only then did Dirk see a huge block of black stone shaped like a sarcophagus. He tensed and threw himself forward, only to be stopped by the chains as he identified it as some kind of altar used for sacrificial rituals. Sheer horror widened his eyes above the gag as he recognized Summer in a white gown spread-eagled on top of the great black stone, as if somehow bound to the hard surface. A cold fear ran through him as he struggled like a madman in a futile attempt to break his chains or pull them from their rings. Despite a strength enhanced by adrenaline, his efforts were in vain. No humans numbering less than 4 Arnold Schwarzeneggers could have broken the links of the chains or pulled them out of the stone chair. Still, he fought until he hadn't the strength to struggle any longer. The lights suddenly blinked out, and the odd sounds of Celtic music echoed among the upright stones. 10 minutes later, they flashed on again, revealing the 30 women in their colorful flowing gowns. Their red hair gleamed under the lights, and the silver flecks on their skin twinkled like stars. Then the lights spiraled as they had many times before as Epona appeared in her golden peplos gown. She stepped up to the black sacrificial altar, raised her hand, and began to chant, O daughters of Odysseus and Circe, may life be taken from those who are not worthy. Epona's voice droned on, pausing as the other women raised their arms and chanted in unison. As before, the chant was repeated, becoming louder before dropping off to inaudible whispers as they lowered their arms. Dirk could see that Summer was oblivious to her surroundings. She stared at Epona and the columns rising around the altar, not seeing them. There was no fear in her eyes. She was so heavily drugged that she had no concept of the threat on her life. Epona reached inside the folds of her gown and raised the ceremonial dagger above her head. The other women came up the steps and surrounded their goddess, also producing daggers held above their heads. Dirk's green eyes were stricken. They were the eyes of someone who knows his world will soon be shrouded in tragedy. He screamed in anguish, but the sound of his voice was muted by the gag. Epona then uttered the death chant. Here lies one who should not have been born. Her knife and the knives of the others glinted under the swirling lights.